Hi, this is Steve. Today's podcast is the second in a series of five we recorded with the professionals at Brain's Potential in Grand Rapids beginning in July of 2020. These podcasts are adapted from their Effective Parenting series. For those of you unfamiliar with Brain's Potential, their mission is to maximize the potential of families through understanding the complex relationships between the brain, body, and real life. Their philosophy is to redefine potential by understanding each person's unique strengths and limitations and to incorporate these into attainable goals. They provide services to address each person's needs while assisting in applying skills into the home, school, and community. Our first episode covered the fundamentals of autism, diagnostic criteria, and the effects of the mind-body connection. You can listen to the first episode at nlawki.com. That's nlawki.com. Today we explore the effective parenting techniques for families with children on the autism spectrum from ages 0 to 10. Brianna Kuhechek is our guest. Bree has a master's in education from Arizona State University and is a board-certified behavioral analyst. We will be posting a PowerPoint of this presentation on our Navigating Life as We Know It website and our NLawki Chat Cafe Facebook page. You can find more information about Brain's Potential as well as contact information for our guest speakers at brainspotential.com. And now, on to our conversation with Bree Kuhechek. Hi, this is Steve with Navigating Life as We Know It, and today we are visiting with Brianna Kuhechek of Brain's Potential about the Putting the Pieces Together Parenting Workshop. We already had one workshop that we've covered, and this is part two, which is for families with children 10 years old and younger. Brianna, or would you prefer I call you Bree?
Yeah, Bree works.
Okay. Just to get a little background on what you do at Brains, I know you've been there for a little over 3 years now, 2017, I guess, is when you started.
And yes.
Could you explain to our listeners what a board-certified behavioral analyst is and what you do?
I would love to. So a board-certified behavior analyst, which is shortened to BCBA, typically oversees applied behavioral analysis. And most people associate that, and I'll use the acronym ABA, most people associate that with autism. Applied behavior analysis has actually been around for a long time, longer than even before the kind of boom or rise of autism. And it's a scientific-based research that just does exactly what it says. It uses applied science to solve behavior change or to provide behavior change. And so when we talk about the autism community, you know, there isn't a cure necessarily that has been found to be associated with autism. So ABA has become that gold standard for an option for treatment. And so when we talk about ABA treating individuals on the spectrum, we're looking at what core deficits an individual on the spectrum might have. Oftentimes that is social or communication. Sometimes it's independent or daily living skills. Other times it can just be kind of some of those relational skills that have to do with communication. And one of the myths about ABA is that it can only work with individuals with autism that have problem behavior. And while we do address quite a few problem behaviors, that's not the main goal of it. We address those problem behaviors to then address skill deficits. And so we talk a lot about skill acquisition and helping individuals with autism gain additional skills that they may be lacking because of the diagnosis. So as a BCBA, I oversee a program that works with individuals. And how we do that is we have individual tutors working with individual kids. And then I kind of pop around and make sure that they're following a treatment plan and that kids are getting treatment to address the goals that we write with families based on individual needs.
And I would imagine because autism spectrum is very, very broad that many of these plans can vary quite a bit from each other.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we, even in our program, which is small, you know, it started about 3 years ago around the same time that I started. We have an 18-month-old that is already showing some verbal delays and lack of eye contact, all the way to a 16-year-old who may have some language but is not doing well in school because they don't have some of those executive functioning skills, which I know is another hot-button term. But when I talk about that, I talk about planning, so using a calendar, turning in their homework, doing that type of thing. So when you look at that, and then we have people in between that, you know, maybe they are nonverbal and need to work on bathing, washing hands, using the bathroom independently. So there's a broad spectrum, as most people know about autism, but also a broad spectrum in which ADA can work with those individuals on the spectrum.
Now, speaking as someone who has no background in what your profession is, but being a parent of five, youngest one is 30 years old, I understand that behavior often is a form of communication. I mean, let's say inappropriate behavior is a form of communication. So when a parent might be focusing on inappropriate or problem behaviors, it could be because their son or daughter isn't able to communicate effectively. And I would imagine that might resolve some of the behaviors.
Yeah, I love to say that. You stole one of my favorite phrases. Behavior is communication. And what we believe as analysts, so in our science of ABA, is that learned behavior matters. So everyone has a pattern of learned behavior, and they have a history of reinforcement. And I'll use these kind of important terms, and they sound scary, but they're really easy when you boil it down. You know, to break it down, you go to work and you get paid, you're probably going to show up for work again. If you go to work for the week and then at the end of the day, there's nothing in your bank account, you're probably not showing up on Monday. And so we all have a learned history and a reinforcement history that makes us continue to do the things we do. Same thing when we look at verbal behavior. If somebody's saying something, if I ask you to do something for me and you do it, then I'm probably going to ask you in that same way nicely. If I don't ask you nicely and you don't do it, well, then I'm probably going to ask you differently the next time. When we look at kids that maybe don't have verbal language, if they hit you and you give them something, well, the next time they're probably going to hit you to get that thing again. So it definitely is a big part of ABA, which we haven't talked about, is working with parents. We call that caregiver training, in which we help parents recognize those things, the functions of a behavior, so that they will stop responding to the hitting, and we can shape up either verbal behavior or doing something like a tap, or, you know, something, again, functional but more appropriate than a hit or an inappropriate request of any kind.
Can tell from talking to you previously, you really enjoy what you do.
I do, yeah. I absolutely enjoy it. I definitely enjoy working with families. I think, as you mentioned, when we talk about this, often parents, when I speak to them, can laugh a little bit because you're like, oh yeah, I remember that time when they screamed at me and I was like, fine, take the iPad. and obviously they know that wasn't the right response, but parents aren't perfect. And
no.
So there's grace in that too. But being able to converse with parents and say, all right, you're not going to be perfect, but how do we now change that pattern so that your kid can gain skills to move forward in life? Because we are creating patterns here. And I think that's one of the most difficult things, especially having a kid on the spectrum, is that they are more black and white than their neurotypical peers. So as parents, you also have to live within that black and white and make sure that you are abiding in that, because it makes such a big difference. And so even though I know that parents aren't going to be perfect, we have to constantly be on to think about, what does that reinforce? What does that do? Because that behavior is going to be more difficult to change in the future. I always tell parents, their kids are very smart. Your kid is very smart. They have a learned history. But when we have that, it gets more and more difficult to reverse, because that connection of why would it be different is often what people on the spectrum struggle with.
Which is why it's better to be working with them at an earlier age.
Absolutely. it's not too late if you've missed that, which is one of the big things that we do talk about in the, you know, the program for kids 10 and under. And that's why there is a program coming up for kids that are 10 and older, because just because you weren't hitting during that early intervention, while that is the best time to target, you're not too late. You're never too late.
I do want to say, as a parent, I really, really, really appreciate your acknowledgement that parents aren't always perfect. Recapping the first chapter of Parenting Workshop was about the basics of autism. And a couple things was mentioned as three functional levels of autism. Could you just briefly describe the three functional levels?
Yeah, absolutely. So the autism spectrum has always been a spectrum. It was changed in the DSM, which is kind of the diagnostic report for all types of disabilities, just a few years ago. And so a lot of people are unfamiliar that there isn't a classification of Asperger's anymore, that everything is on this spectrum. So when we think about levels, that's kind of what it did, is they changed to this leveling program. So there's level 1, 2, and 3. Level 1 is requiring some support, but pretty high functioning. So again, if you had to put it into those old categories, you might think of high-functioning autism or those Asperger's, so they are on the spectrum. We definitely see some of those behaviors and core deficits, but you don't need a ton of support. They probably don't even really need ABA services, because ABA is an intensive service, but they might need some support with some of those, again, executive functioning skills. So how do I set up this calendar or do some time management? And then there's level 2, which is requiring substantial support. And so that would be where we start to look at, you know, the introduction of additional therapies, whether that be OT or speech, ABA, or just even a school IEP. And then the level 3 is requiring very substantial support. So when we look at individuals on the spectrum, that might be more of our kids that are nonverbal, or that need additional substantial support in those daily living skills, because they're not doing any of that independently. Sometimes parents are like, oh, I knew that we had a diagnosis. I have no idea what my level is. And you can see that by going to the back of your diagnostic report, wherever you got that. There's a summary of the diagnosis, and it will actually say which level of autism they have diagnosed within your child. So if you're unsure of what it is and can't find it, I would ask, you know, the person that provided those results or gave the test.
Now, I would guess that there's not a brick wall between these three, that something might appear to be like 1.235, and somebody might be, depending upon the day, they could move between one or the other?
So I wouldn't say depending upon the day, but I would say that it can vary based on the categories in which the deficits are. So someone could be great at communication, but still have very repetitive and rigid behaviors. So they could be in separate categories, like maybe a level 2 in one category and level 3 in another. And so, but as far as changing on the day, most likely that is going to carry over within every functioning level that they have. And that's when testing looks at providing a level. They say, okay, in your life, how is autism affecting you? And at what level and which is it affecting your daily life?
Okay. The next thing was the mind-body connection. And I think that that's basically a connection between the intellect and the gut of an individual,
Yeah. How
they feel.
And I won't elaborate too much on this. Our OT that was present, Sean, went into this a little bit more. But basically, it's just saying, when we look at autism as a medical diagnosis, we also have to look at what else is going on physically. Because sometimes those behaviors or even a skill deficit that may exist may not be due to the diagnosis of autism. It may be due to something else that's going on. A lot of individuals with ASD have some different, as you mentioned, like gut things. So have we looked at what they're eating? Have we looked at the way in which they're even having bowel movements regularly? Have we looked at their ability to engage in fine motor and gross motor tasks? Because a lot of our kids have low tone. And so when we think about things like that, and we're looking at our individuals on the spectrum, we also have to recognize that there's going to be a connection to the body and then also to the mind in order for those restaurants to fire to make those new skills develop. So there is definitely a connection. And I think the main point and takeaway is that we all have to work together, which is why kids often receive more than just a single service if they're in that level two, level three range.
And I think the way I understand that the most is the term hangry, when you're hungry, and it makes you a little bit less patient with things. You can see how that can affect in many different ways. I know that my son has a very, very high tolerance for pain. And when he says something hurts, it'd probably be excruciating for somebody else. But that could affect his behavior long before he complains about it. And the same thing for some of the digestive issues where you're just feeling lousy, but you don't really know why. And it's really hard if you have challenges in verbal behavior to try to explain that. So I really Absolutely. Appreciate that you're separating what's causing this. We have a tendency to blame everything on autism.
Yeah, one of the first things I tell parents is that, you know, as a professional, my job is to rule out medical first. So if a parent comes to me and says, hey, this new weird thing is happening, right? This behavior is occurring. A lot of times it ends up being finger biting. And my first question isn't like, okay, we have to put in an intervention. It's the, well, are they getting any teeth in? Do they have any loose teeth? Because that might be what it is. And so again, just that association with there might just be a something with their body going on. It might not be this brand new behavior that's popped up due to the autism.
The last thing we talked about on the first session on the fundamentals of autism was barriers that are encountered. Could you please elaborate on that a bit?
Sure. So just to recap, I think one of the things that we talked about with the families that were present is just the recognition that barriers exist when you have kids in general, but especially kids on the spectrum, and just the way it affects your daily life, your ability to have relationships, and then your ability to monitor your finances and even how it impacts your employment. Without going into too much detail, we just kind of talked about some of those and worked through. There are ways to get support. And if you don't know of any of those ways, then you are definitely welcome to contact me or a member of our Brains team. And we'd love to give you resources to just help, because the biggest thing is recognizing that there are barriers and saying, okay, I'm not the only one struggling with this. But how could I get support to have a healthy family unit, whether that's relationships between siblings or relationship with you and your child, getting respite or a break from your kid every once in a while if you don't know? Where do I go to find somebody that would be able to support my kid so that I could get a break? There are things like that that exist in the community, and we have a lot of those resources, and would be happy to connect families to that so that those barriers, while they may still exist, we can overcome them, or at least give some support so that you can have some breathing room.
I've noticed over and over again at Brains that you're talking about the family rather than just the individual. You're talking about the relationships, the environment that they live in. Children do sometimes exhibit behaviors that are a result of the environment they're in. And I've noticed, and many other parents I've spoken to, if you're having a very, very bad day, the chances are your child's not going to behave the same way as if you're having a good day. They kind of feed off the negative or positive energy. And so you really have to work with the relationship rather than just with the child.
Yeah, absolutely. You're definitely right. And again, that leads me just back to a statement I said earlier, and I wanted to say it again, because I think, unfortunately, families don't hear this a lot. Your kids are very smart. They're very intuitive. And I don't care where they are at in that level system, they know what's going on, and they do respond to that and to your behavior as much as you respond to theirs.
And speaking as a parent with a nonverbal child who sometimes seems to be distracted, do not ever think that they're not listening when you're talking, especially about them.
Yeah.
With COVID-19, there's talk of a vaccination coming up. And I know that there's a big connection, or has been at least, between autism and vaccines. And it might not change anybody else's opinion about this, but could you give us a little bit of insight from your standpoint as a professional, what might be valid or invalid about that connection between vaccinations and autism?
Sure. So this could be a whole nother episode. But
I know.
The main thing that I want to just state very clearly is that vaccines do not cause autism. If you've read that somewhere, there is no scientific research supporting it. And vaccines do not cause autism. There is no current cause that research has led to, but it is not caused by vaccines. So vaccines can keep you safe, can keep your kids safe, and are recommended, and they are not putting your child at risk for autism. I think that's important for parents with kids currently or thinking about having children, but I also think it's important for parents that have had kids that now have a diagnosis to also hear, in case they are putting that burden on themselves of what if I did this to your kid? You did not. Again, if I can reiterate anything, it's that vaccines do not cause autism. I think a lot of parents live with that guilt. They do even think that or have read something, and it's not factual.
Parent guilt doesn't need fact. It's something that we're gifted with. But there are some reactions to vaccines occasionally because people's biology is so different from one to the next, and that causes suspicion. But I think we're entering a very dangerous world when vaccines become suspect, because in my lifetime, there were a lot of diseases that no longer really prevail. Measles and mumps and chicken pox and things like that that generally don't happen so much anymore. And with COVID-19, that might be something that requires a vaccine every year or two, or we don't know yet. It might not be a 20-year shot. And as serious as it is, it's important for people to understand that vaccines are something significant to be considered, and it does not have any proven causal effect with autism. So thanks for your comments on that. I think it's important to keep preaching that.
Absolutely.
Bree, what are some of the greatest concerns that family members have when you first meet them? They're coming in with a child that perhaps had a perfectly typical birth and development, and then they hit a section where they're not growing and they're not developing the right way, and there must be some concerns. Can you speak to that a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a difficult question because when we look at those levels, it varies. So I can kind of talk maybe about what those concerns are broadly, and maybe each of those levels might be a good way. So
okay.
When we look at those, you know, level one, level two, so requiring some support, but, you know, they just got a diagnosis and that's scary. What does that mean? Like, is my kid going to be okay? Are they going to be able to participate in school? Do I talk about the diagnosis? So there's a lot of fear because when you get a diagnosis and you know that you've heard the word autism, but you maybe haven't had a ton of exposure, the exposure that you have had is very limited, and that was maybe not a great exposure. And so then it becomes, a scary thing. That parents just kind of want to know, what does this diagnosis mean? And that's where it boils down to individuals. I think, again, looking at those kids that need some limited support, parents often go towards school. How is this going to impact our school? Are they going to be able to continue in a classroom with their peers? Are they going to graduate? Or what is this? And so that is one of the main concerns that I hear from families initially, is just kind of coping or starting to wrap their mind around what is a diagnosis and how does it affect my child. You know, there are definitely some concerns if a child is displaying behaviors in the home or at school of, okay, there's this behavior and I don't know what to do. I've maybe parented other kids and it's, you know, gone fine, and now here this is, and they have autism, so I don't want to be mean, but we can't live like this. And so I think if we're looking at that behavioral side, parents want to get control because they are seeking support because things are very quickly getting out of control. Other parent concerns that come in, they have to do with some of those delayed skills in independent living. So maybe the kid is, you know, 5, 6, 10 or older and has yet to be independent in toileting. And so, you know, that's something that we really want to target pretty quick. There are a lot of different things that parents come with. But I think one of the big things, because we're talking about kids 10 and younger, is a family has received a new diagnosis and they're just really wanting to figure out, what does that affect on my child? So when we talk with parents, I think the first thing is recognizing that your kid is an individual and this diagnosis is individual to your child. And so let's figure out the skills first that your child does have. So I was, you know, first of all, doing an assessment, but also talking with the parents about some of the other stuff they can do, because they can do a lot. And then let's figure out where the gaps are so we can work towards that. And then if problem behavior is happening, well, when is it happening? Is it happening because you're asking them to do something? Is it happening because you're removing something that they like to do? Is it happening and you just don't know why? And so starting to just kind of dig in to figuring out the individual hopefully helps that parent recognize that this blanket diagnosis they've received doesn't have to wait as heavy, because their kid is still an individual human being.
The next area to talk about was, how do parents deal with stress? The parents that you're working with, what do they do in their lives in order to, let's say, deal with the level of stress that might be coming out of the therapies their children are receiving? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. And it's difficult. I think a lot of parents participate in parent groups. Other, you know, nobody's really doing too much in person these days, but if it is in person and that's something, it's online, you know, getting on groups on Facebook or connecting with other parents in the community, just to feel like you're not the only one going through something. And I think some other things is just making sure that you have a good support system so that you can take those mental health breaks for yourself, because it can be exhausting, especially if you are trying really hard to live in that black and white, so that that learned behavior pattern can be appropriate for your kid, that you are making sure that there's time out for yourself. And those things are difficult, but some, you know, just asking for support, I think, is the biggest thing. And a lot of us, I can't say all of us, but a lot of us struggle to ask for help or raise our hand and say, oh, I'm struggling here. This is more difficult than I thought. But as I mentioned earlier, those resources do exist, and no one is going to fault you for saying that you're not a perfect parent. So best to ask, because it's a stressful thing to be a parent, especially when you're a parent to an individual on the spectrum.
You know, I've known parents that have said, if you suggest self-care to them, they reject that because their perception is that selfish. They should be focusing on their child. And I've been guilty of not taking care of myself too. There is a tendency to focus on your child to be able to make their life better and not invest in yourself.
Well, and I think if I can speak, you know, from a different perspective, the reason that I preach self-care so much is because as an analyst, when I come in and we do a caregiver training, I know that I'm giving you one more thing to do. You're often working full-time, whether that's at a job somewhere or you're a full-time parent. And now I'm saying, hey, you're going to go above and beyond that, and I'm going to also give you homework or also give you another job assignment. So if I'm giving you more things to do, you're probably, if you're exhausted, not going to do it with fidelity, right? You're not going to follow through as best as you need to if you're not also taking care of yourself. So I would actually argue that by doing self-care, you are becoming a better parent, because you are going to have more energy to respond the way you need to. And we talk about that. I think that's why I talk about the family unit, and we covered this a little bit in our first session that we did, is saying, find those people within your family, or it's outside of your family either, that are your tap-in people, so that when you're exhausted, you know that they are also going to respond appropriately. Because you're going to have to tap out sometimes, and that's normal, and that should be allowed. But you want to know that that person that you're tapping out to and that they're tapping in are also caring just as much and are going to follow through in the same way that you know you should, based on your child, not just carrying that burden alone, but finding those people that can be your good tap out, tap in people, so that your child's always getting the best level of care, even if that's not just given by you.
Very wise advice. Thank you. Early intervention, ages 0 to 3. What kind of supports and what kind of services are available for early intervention, and why is that important?
Sure. So early intervention, it's also, can be 0 to 5. It kind of depends. So usually early intervention is associated with schools. So if your kid has a diagnosis and they're diagnosed early, which is autism, they can be diagnosed as early as 18 months. And on average, I would say most early interventions get caught around 2 years for when we're looking at ASD. But they can be eligible to receive additional supports from your school district. It's usually a comprehensive approach that has some type of speech, occupational therapy, physical therapy, behavioral therapy. Again, it's based on child needs, but it really says, oh, wow, we notice this now. Let's catch it early so that we can minimize those gaps that persist between them and their peers early on when basically their brain is a sponge and soaking up so much more. From a behavioral standpoint, they don't have a long history of that learned behavior. You mentioned, you know, your son is, I think you said 32, right?
Yes.
And so he's 32. I still believe a lot of progress can be made. He can still learn a lot of new skills. But when we look at finding motivators or changing a pattern of behavior, think about how much longer that history is when you're 32 than when you're 2 or 3. And so that's another really big reason that we say early works.
And what types of therapies are available?
Often it's occupational therapy. There's physical therapy, speech therapy, and then behavioral therapy, which is most often associated with ABA if you're looking outside of a school district.
Can you explain what the word occupational means in the sense of occupational therapy?
Yeah, so when we talk about occupational therapy, often it is looking at working with sensory problems or cognitive problems. So again, that mind-body connection, I would say, is the best way to think about it. So often with younger kids, you're talking about a 2-year-old, maybe we're looking at that fine motor dexterity. So has their pincer grip started to develop? Are they able to pull up on things? So they have low tone that we need to work on building that tone up so they're able to participate in more gross motor activities. So when you're looking at those developmental milestones that your kid's supposed to hit, if they're not hitting the physical marks, then you might be looking at some occupational therapy as being an appropriate thing because they should be hitting some of those developmental milestones that have to do specifically with that motor development.
So occupational basically is hand-eye coordination and fine motor skills?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for tuning in to Navigating Life as We Know It. If you're enjoying the show, please join us on Facebook, support us on Patreon, but most importantly, like, subscribe, and follow our podcast. The best way to do that is on your favorite podcasting platform or go to www.nlawki.com. That's www.nlawki.com. Thanks so much. Have a wonderful listening experience, and I'll let you get back to your episode now.
What are some of the early concerns that parents have with their children that have a diagnosis of autism? You covered a few of them already.
Yeah, so speech development is definitely one. Again, I think with most families, they are paying attention to those developmental milestones, or if they're not, maybe they have friends or other family members that are saying, oh, my kids started speaking already, or was talking at this age, or doing certain things. So I think as those milestones are missed, mm-hmm. then they become concerned. So that's usually something that we're looking at, and usually when families start to notice something might be going on, and then talk to their pediatrician. A lot of pediatricians now, actually, when they have you fill out your surveys that they do, are screening for autism. So you might see questions about, is your kid making eye contact? Are they giggling? And some of those are to pre-screen for autism diagnosis. Obviously, that wouldn't provide your child or scare anybody from checking yes or no on those. But it's just a good checkpoint for your pediatrician to say, oh, okay, well, you know, at this age, they should be hitting this milestone. If they're not, maybe that's something more. And then potentially if there are a lot of those that are missed, then maybe that would be a good idea to then go and get some additional testing. And so some of those early on things that families point out or are concerned about is definitely the language development. Often when we see a lag in language development, that's when we see an increase in problem behavior, because as we talked about earlier, behavior is communication. It doesn't always have to be negative behavior either, but if your kid is smiling and clapping their hands and that's always bringing, you know, food or preferred item or your attention, then they might do that more often as well. then you've got the physical aspects of it. So the types of things that we just talked about with occupational therapy. You also have the social pieces. So are they interactively playing with toys and others? Are they making eye contact? Are they trying to engage peers? Are they doing any sort of mutual play, or is it all independent? And are we seeing any progress in doing that? And then those isolated or rigid interests. Often our individuals on the spectrum, I hear from parents, you know, I buy them all of these toys and they're just not interested in anything, but they want to watch the fan. Or, you know, they every time we go by an air conditioner unit, that's, you know, they want to look at or drop something in something else. So there's some rigid behaviors that can also be just something that parents want to work through, because it can isolate them from peers. And we all want to have social relationships.
Well, one other one here was about sensory aversions or preferences. If you have a nonverbal child, how do you determine what some of these aversions or preferences might be when it comes to sensory issues?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of that is you as a parent learning yourself and recognizing, wow, every time I put this shirt with a tag on, there is a lot of problem behavior, or I say problem behavior to cover a wide variety, whether that's screaming or hitting or just flopping to the ground, or every time they walk into this room that has really, you know, this really loud fan or really bright light. We've learned that, oh, headphones, like we had headphones that just helped, so I had it that one time. Or, you know, oh, I found these shirts without tags, and now when we get dressed, it's no longer a problem. And so I think parents independently find a lot of those things, especially when it comes to sensory more so. When we look at other types of behaviors, parents often have found a workaround. So, oh, they didn't like this, but then I played their favorite video or I gave them the iPad and that always solved it. And then when we come in, we meaning ABA, we might have a conversation with the parent of, we're glad that worked. And, you know, sometimes we have to use those things. What happens when the iPad's not there or the iPad dies? Well, that would be a huge issue. Okay, well, then we're going to work through that. It's a lot easier to look for shirts and continue to only buy clothes without tags. It's harder to always guarantee that you're going to have a form of technology around, maybe not for all of us, because we always have it, but, you know, maybe there's not Wi-Fi or something. And if that's going to instantly increase problem behavior, we might need to teach a different type of skill to work through that and build up some of those tolerating skills or accepting those skills. And that's a lot of the things that we do in ABA as well.
Can you talk about some of the key skills for early learners?
Sure. Yeah, I definitely can. So when we look at physical skills, we're looking at fine motor, gross motor, oral motor, visual motor, coordination. So I know that sounded like a lot, but just thinking of your whole body, especially early on, there's so much that's supposed to develop all in sync. And if that's not, that's when we need to target individually. A lot of times kids may be able to do a lot of gross motor things, but that fine motor is not there. And there's some aversion that's related to something like writing or something like putting on their shoes. And we might think it's a skill deficit with being able to do that actual skill, but it might actually be a motor deficit. And we need to work on building those muscles within that motor development. Some other key skills with early learners. Oh, there's a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you want to talk more about just the physical for a little bit, or do you want to just kind of high-level everything?
High-level, I think, because we could be here for hours, I'm sure, with very valuable information.
Yeah, so I think that's good for just motor. Other early skills that we look at are, you know, daily living skills. And obviously, we're going to move outside of earlier intervention here and go 0 to 10. But we do think mm-hmm. about toileting, hand-washing, bathing, brushing teeth, dressing, some aspects of grooming, and eating. Those are all skills that should start to exist. And if they don't, then how do we teach them? One of the keys that I gave our families that were present, and I'll pass along to your listeners, is in ABA, we use a term called a task analysis. Basically, what that means is that every task that we have, and you can think about it yourself, it's broken down into these little sub-skills, right? So if I'm saying, hey, we're going to put on our shirt, well, let's think about all of the different sub-skills that takes. One, it means I have to be able to lift my hands over my head. Two, it means I have to be able to orient a shirt and recognize that there are three different holes in that shirt, and one is for my head, two are for my arms. Then I have to be able to pull down, and it goes on and on and on. And so when we think about skills and how many sub-skills there are, it can really help when you're looking to work with your child and saying, well, no wonder you're getting frustrated with this entire task. I might need to break this down. So the term I gave is called task analysis. And one of the things that I encourage parents to do if they're not receiving therapy is that the internet is wonderful, and you can often Google something like dressing task analysis, showering task analysis, brushing teeth task analysis. You can Google those things, and a lot of therapists like myself or an OT or even speech, they have created via their own blogs or even just posted different things, whether it's like visual schedules to show those different sub-skills, or they might just give you a whole list. And then as a parent, you can start to break those down. Maybe you're doing some of those skills with your kiddo, you know, to help prompt them through it, and then you're allowing them to do the last couple skills independently and building that tolerance and also building that independence. And it's sometimes difficult for parents and all of us to think through, oh, wow, there are a lot of different steps. I thought they just hated putting their shoes on. and so that's something I definitely encourage people to do if they're hitting one of those skills that early learners should have and don't have, and it's always being associated with problem behavior, is maybe thinking, what's the breakdown and what's the point in which that your child is getting frustrated? Let's just target that area. And it might be, a physical deficit, or it might just be they don't know how to do that specific part, and we need to really just target teaching that one specific part.
It reminds me, when we've talked before about this and the different skills that are used for daily activity, daily living skills, the different steps in each of the skills. Very much that most adults would do when organizing a to-do list or a calendar. We put down all the things that have to be done. And if we're doing something which is brand new, we might go on YouTube to find out what the steps are to do it successfully. It's something that we do as adults, and we don't think about the necessity for breaking down how to brush your teeth into 6 or 8 steps. But that's one way that people can gain some confidence and perhaps see the larger task as being easier because you can do one step at a time. And I know that in the presentation, you went through several things, the toileting and the hand washing and how you go through all the steps. And again, it might seem tedious to us, but if you're doing this for the first time, you have a hard time learning the process. This Google task analysis is a great tool. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because that is a great way for people to be able to do some of this themselves at home.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, we're talking about the spectrum of learners. Sometimes your learner doesn't need everything broken down, but just even to see the visual of the breakdown might be the only reminder that they needed. You know, they always come out with their pants on, but they're not zipped. Well, if we could just have a visual of the end thing that we do is zip the pants, that might be really helpful. And so even just kind of getting outside of just what you have been doing and utilizing Google in this case, or other therapists, to be creative for you, because I do think it can be difficult. As parents, don't even have time. You know, you don't have time to do all of this. And so another thing that I just want to mention is, when I talk to parents, one of the burdens that I feel they have is recognizing the feeling as though there's so much that they need to fix. And I always tell them, like, you have to start with one thing. You mentioned a to-do list. When you start your to-do list, you don't think that you're going to check them all off at once. So I often will work with my families to make a kind of, I hate using goal sheets because I think we talk about goals a lot,
yeah,
whether that be in a treatment plan or in an IEP. I mean, goals is just, it's almost an aversion, I think, for a lot of families. So I like to use a different phrase than just saying your priorities. Like, what are your priorities? And don't think too hard. Write them down. We'll look at it again in 6 months. It's fine. They shift. They shift for me. If I wrote my to-do list today, it would be different than my to-do list tomorrow, a week
Absolutely.
From now, 6 months from now. And you know, our kids on the spectrum, they do need you to have that priority to remain for a good amount of time to give them opportunity to learn that skill, because it's going to take a little bit longer. But it's okay if the third thing on your list then becomes first and, you know, 2 weeks from now because of where they're at or something different. And I just think having that also as a parent frees you up to recognize, well, I don't have to do it all, but it would really make a big difference in my life if they could put their shirt on independently. And so that's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to really focus on that. And then I'm also not just going to practice that with them when I'm rushing it out of the door and have three kids to get ready and I'm late for work. I'm going to actually practice that and have them put their shirt on and off multiple times during our evening when I have more time, so that that practice and repetition can have a history of reinforcement, right? So, I know they hate putting their shirt on and off. If every time they get their tablet or they get a cookie or they get, you know, whatever it is for your kid, all of a sudden putting their shirt on actually is the greatest thing in the world. It doesn't have to be terrible, but it probably is terrible when they only do it that one time in the morning when they're tired and it never gets them anything except going to school. And so those are things that I think, you know, as parents, we just have to think through. And unfortunately, you know, well, fortunately or unfortunately, not everyone has access to ABA, whether that be because their kid is on that more level one or unfortunately, meaning their insurance isn't covering it right now. But there are tips and tricks like that to use and that are available. And so, again, resources are out there. I'm always happy to help families brainstorm, too.
In terms of social behavior, which seems to be one of the concerns people have in a child's development, because they might not play with other kids properly, or they might be kind of in their own world, there's a number of things that were covered during the presentation. We can't do all of them and keep this under 2 hours, but there's a social behavior and social play. Can you talk about some of the development of social skills, and maybe we can get in some types of behavior and with safety skills?
Sure. Yeah. So some of the things that we look at and that tend to be lacking are eye contact, initiating interactions with others, requesting things from others, responding to questions and requests, and then doing any type of like pretend play are often things that families note that are missing, or that we feel, again, based on assessment, that we need to work on to minimize those gaps between their neurotypical peers. And so there are definitely ways to do this. I think starting with familiar people, and so that could be a family member, it could just be a safe peer if they have one, you know, a family friend or a friend from school. But starting to minimize those prompts is really important. I think a lot of times parents, especially for social interactions, we get nervous that our kid doesn't say hello right away, and people are going to think they're rude, or it was kind of honestly even just embarrassing for us. And recognizing, hey, if we're working on this skill, then I'm going to delay prompting them say hello as soon as somebody walks in, because I want to give them the opportunity to make that connection. And I know that connection might be slower than what mine is. So from a parent perspective, I think as you work on these things, being okay with letting your kids struggle, if you know that you're working on it or have taught it, because that connection, again, it might be there, but it's going to take a little bit longer to say, oh yeah, I say hello, or even looking at how to fade those prompts for those social interactions. So instead of giving them the words, say hello, what do we say? Like, or, oh, someone's here, or look. And then hopefully that, you know, history has been established so that then they can say hello independently or more independently than just providing the words and having it be an echo. As far as play with others, one of the big things that I talk with parents about is just start with doing your child's preferred mode of play. You know, that might look like it's just play next to each other, but if your child really likes the tablet, okay, could they just have someone else sit by them and then start to work into playing more age-appropriate or even developmentally appropriate games with others. But that was not something to start with. Social play and interactions with others could, again, be a whole other thing, because there are a lot of deficits that are associated with autism and social interaction.
And I think that's probably the biggest connection people make is the social interactions.
Yeah. If I can say just one more thing to the social aspect, the other thing is, again, priorities. So if we know that this is one of the hardest things for our kids on the spectrum, well, then don't think we're going to tackle an entire social interaction. So if you're going to a party or even to Christmas with extended family, well, that's going to be a lot. And so if our goal is that they interact for the entire 3 hours that we're there, and this is one of the most difficult things in their life, think about if you had to do the most difficult thing in your life. I even think about just working out for 3 hours. Like, no way. There's no
I can't
way
even imagine that.
Yeah, exactly. And so it might be, hey, you know what? We are working on high and we're going to say hi to 5 people. And then that's enough because we are working on really building the independence with greetings or saying, you know, greetings, hello and goodbye. But the middle, I'm not worried about the middle right now because I know my priority list and other people can judge me for it, but that is not my priority right now. And that's, you know, and I think when you can have confidence because you know where you're going, then parents, some of that guilt can fade away because you feel more confident in the fact that you know where you're going. Oftentimes parents just don't know where to go, and then they go everywhere and make progress nowhere. I often will use a circle with arrows going everywhere.
Parents are more confident when they know that they are making progress. And so often we'll talk about, you know, if you're somewhere and your arrows are going everywhere, you're unfortunately stuck. If you have an arrow and you're moving, then we're actually moving and we're going somewhere, and then you're going to feel much better, even if it's only accomplishing one thing, because it was accomplished. And so to build that confidence and to relieve some of that guilt, know that, and people are always going to have their comments, but if you are standing firm and you can see that progress, I think some of that fades away because you'll be able to see that progress with your kid, and that'll feel really good, as opposed to feeling like you're trying so hard and not getting anywhere because you're, again, trying to go everywhere.
Don't you find that when a child is able to do something new that they can master, that actually gives them some more self-confidence and maybe is a positive, healthy thing for them and for parents?
Oh, absolutely. And I think part of the reason that is you mentioned this earlier, your kid is very intuitive. So when you're in a great mood, they know it. When you're not, they know it. And guess what happens with parents when a kid develops a new skill? They usually show it. Like, wow, buddy. Oh my gosh. And that feels good. Social interactions lacking or not, a kid knows their parent and often can read that body language, even if they're not looking at your facial expressions.
In some cases, I actually think, and I don't want to sound too wacky here, but there's a different energy in the room. You don't even have to anything. It's the way you move. It's the expression on your face. It's very subtle, but they do pick up on that.
Or even the way that you're touching, you know, physical touch. Like, oh my gosh, yes. There is definitely, I don't want to sound wacky either, but definitely a different energy, if we can say that.
Sure. I have no doubt that that's a factor. One more thing before we wrap up. The difference between a bribe and a consequence is the placement.
Yeah.
When we're talking about offering an incentive or a reward, could you please go into a little more detail between a bribe and a consequence, being the placement is the difference between the two?
Absolutely, yes. So you said it correctly. The difference between a bribe and a consequence is the placement in which you're putting that desired thing or that outcome. So a good example of this is your kid is throwing a tantrum, right? You said, hey, it's time to get ready for bed. It's an instant meltdown. Maybe they're flopping to the ground. Okay, there's a tantrum there. And then all of a sudden it's, hey, if you go to bed, then you can get a cookie. And then your kid gets up and is like, yeah, that sounds awesome. And so when tomorrow's bedtime comes and you say it's time to go to bed, your kid throws a tantrum because now that history is being created, and maybe it's over a couple of times of doing this, of, hey, when I throw a tantrum, mom offers me a cookie. Because that other time when you said it's time to go to bed and I walked upstairs and there was no cookie. So I'm going to throw a tantrum because that got me a cookie. So that would be a bribe because the placement happened after the behavior was already going.
I was going to say, do parents ever realize that they function exactly the same way in life?
Oh, yeah. I think that is what's funny is sometimes when I'm sitting in, again, what I call parent trainings or caregiver trainings, they'll get a smile on their face. And I'm like, oh, did you think of something that Johnny did or whatever? And they're like, no, about myself. Yes, and then we can laugh about that. So the difference going to the consequence, and consequence when I use the term isn't a negative. I'm not using it in a negative connotation. I just mean what they're getting right. is stating, hey, Johnny, it's time to go to bed. When we go to bed, we get a cookie. Well, then they walk and you put this first then statement, which families are pretty familiar with because they hear it a lot. Like first this, then this. And they placed it before a tantrum happened. So now if Johnny gets the tantrum or, you know, throws a tantrum on the floor, you can decide not to give a cookie. Well, you know, I said, come upstairs and you didn't. So no cookie tonight, buddy. But the next time when you do, I say, come upstairs and then the cookie. You got the cookie because you did the behavior that I asked you to, not the inappropriate behavior. And so there's a slight difference. And when it comes to ABA, I think we get a bad rap for this because people are always like, oh, you guys just give them stuff to get them to do something. And the end goal is not that they would get a cookie every night, but if going to bed has a learning history that's negative, because again, for most kids, they're not getting to play with their most preferred toys. They're not, you know, they're missing opportunities to be downstairs doing whatever it is they want to do. Well, then whatever's upstairs isn't fun. So we have to change that history and then we can fade it. Maybe now we get a cookie every other. Maybe then we go to a chart where it's you go to bed 5 days, you get one cookie because you got your nightly sticker. There's fading procedures that go along with that. But absolutely, do we use things to motivate? Yes. And if you ask me about my own life, do I use things to motivate? Yes. And so there's a very small difference between a bribe and a consequence. And that's why I say it's the placement. And so what I would challenge parents to do next time that you are offering something is think, when did I offer it? Did I offer it based on the bad behavior happening? And if the answer was yes, you're not terrible. But what I'm going to tell you is that next time you tell your kid to do something, they're probably going to engage in that behavior because it was the behavior that got them the reward.
So basically retain the leverage, offer the cookie along before something happens, because you could always take it away.
Absolutely. Yep.
Bree, what parting advice do you have for parents regarding their 0 to 10-year-old child with autism?
Sure. So I'll speak broadly and then I'll speak for ABA since I can.
Okay.
But broadly, I want to just encourage parents that if you or your child has received a diagnosis of autism, the world is not over. And I know that that sounds really out there, but I do feel that families feel that way sometimes. There are a lot of things, a lot of resources, a lot of interventions, and just a lot of support. We didn't talk about school, but just a lot of opportunities for your kid, no matter the age, to gain skills. And if you're feeling stuck, then figure out where those resources are by asking a question, and don't be scared to do that, because there are opportunities to have your kid learn. And if you've heard that they can't, whoever told you that was wrong. That would be honestly my biggest thing that I want to tell parents and families, is that your kid is capable, and we just need to find the right tools to shape up appropriate behaviors and get some of those skills acquired. From an ABA standpoint, our science, again, it isn't new, but it is new in working with individuals with autism. And depending on, you know, what blog you read or what you Google or what you see, sometimes ABA can get a bad reputation. And it's unfortunate. And so just for the sake of my science, I want to just say that there are, just like with everything, good companies and bad companies. And there are good analysts and not so great analysts. But if you have a kid with a spectrum, especially if they are in that level 2 or level 3 range and you are struggling, ask about ABA. It is the gold standard to work with individuals on the spectrum. And it definitely is not just addressing problem behavior. I think that's a myth that families often feel is, oh, well, my kid doesn't like hit me, or my kid doesn't, you know, whatever, that is this terrible thing. And that's not just what ABA is about. It's also increasing skills. Just look into it. A lot of insurances actually have a coverage in your, you know, in your insurance policies that do cover ABA. And if you don't know, you can ask your ABA, an ABA company to look at that for you. You can also ask your insurance provider directly. Medicaid also covers ABA therapy. There is a difference in the age group in which it covers. So private insurance will cover up until the 19th birthday, so 0 to 19. Medicaid will cover 0 to 21, so through the 22nd birthday. And that's a great resource. It's an intensive therapy. So intensive meaning it's probably about minimum 6 hours a week. Might be less once a kid has been in for a little while. But then some kids, again, those level three kids that need some more full-time support can get anywhere from 30 to 40 hours. So it can be a lot of help. And when we look at, you know, parents burning out or needing those supportive resources, ABA can be great for that.
And it also helps the parent learn about how to react and interact.
Absolutely.
Right?
We have a great program at Brains. So I will talk us up. But ethically, if you're receiving ABA elsewhere, you are or should be receiving some type of parent training. So if your supervising BCBA is not doing that for you, you should definitely ask about it. Because according to our board, you should be receiving that and they should be doing that for any kid that they're working with. So as a parent, speak up and advocate if you want more support in learning something about how to help your child.
Well, that's how you sustain the gains, I suppose, and be able to grow, because you're not going to have the ABA therapy forever. It's limited.
Absolutely. And we want those skills to generalize. We all know kids act different with their parents. So we want to make sure that they're doing it with a technician, but also that that same demand or skill can be transferred to a parent or a grandparent or a teacher.
Bree, there's one more last thing I'd like to bring up, and that has to do with relationships, personal relationships in folks with autism. Quite often, it's thought that they don't really have any emotions, but they do. I've seen parents guilty of this, and I can't say I haven't been guilty myself, that people sometimes think with people on the spectrum don't really have feelings for others, that they are loners. But the reality is that every human being needs connection.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, and not to jump back into another conversation, but something to do, and we talked about this a little bit when we had our meeting, is to help a sibling, or even if you're a parent, try to make that connection through where it's already naturally occurring. So if your, you know, kiddo likes to look at fans, if it's something that isolated, or maybe they like a certain show, Daniel Tiger or something else, just sit and engage in that interest with them with no other agenda, because then you may become paired with that preferred thing. And that's how to start to build that. Because yeah, I agree with you completely. People want social interactions, even if their affect may say differently. Absolutely.
Brianna, thank you very much. This has been very helpful. We'll be posting how to connect with Brains.
Absolutely. You can do that. I'm also on the Brains website, so someone can contact me if they're looking at our ABA page as well. But if you Google, since we've talked so much about Google, if you Google Brains in Grand Rapids, you will find it.
Well, I thank you very much for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Hi, I'm Carrie, and welcome once again to the NLOCKY Chat Cafe. I think you know the routine by now. Grab a cup of coffee, or whatever your preferred beverage is, and take a seat. You know, maybe we should rename this establishment to the NLOCKY Chat Cafe and Wine Bar. What do you think? Well, today, Steve spoke with Bree Kuhatchek from Brains Potential in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Their topic was effective parenting for children on the ASD spectrum from age 0 to 10. Steve's here now, so Steve, we're going to do this a little different today, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
Here are the points I want to emphasize from your interview with Bree. One of the things that she mentioned was with early intervention and early diagnosis, then you can get services through the school. But I just wanted to make sure that people understood that those services will be educationally driven or based. So it's not necessarily all of the things that you want to cover, but it's a good chunk of them that are going to be taken care of through the school district
Right. I think a good example was the situation we had with our own son, Liam. The physical therapist made sure that he could sit up properly in the desk and do educationally based activities. But it wasn't to increase mobility or activity that he is able to do outside of the classroom. It was all based upon the educational setting.
Right. The other thing that Bree mentioned that I thought was an absolutely wonderful tool is the Google task analysis.
Yes.
Being able to Google different ones, because we really have started to break that stuff down for Liam. I mean, you just can't throw a goal out there, okay? You have to break it down. First of all, it helps us understand how we're going to model this for him. And so to have that task analyzed and broken down into the steps that are necessary is really, I thought that was a fabulous
and some
tool.
Some tasks require more steps than others.
Right.
Obviously.
Right.
In our case with Liam, we took pictures of him brushing his teeth in various stages and posted them on his mirror. And then all we have to do is point to the first one and he'll follow through all of them. Otherwise, he gets a little bit mixed up sometimes through the process. So the task analysis actually is a description of each of the steps that has to be taken for a child to complete an activity. And it may be more for some activities than others.
I also have to back up just slightly here. A lot of the information that she had was phenomenal. But I'm looking at this from somebody who has a 32-year-old.
Okay? Correct.
If I had a 0 to 10, I probably would have been a lot more interested in the things. But even so, I still picked up really excellent tools, excellent advice. I really liked her idea about prioritizing your goals and then practicing it with follow-through. And I know that a lot of times that can be the hardest piece of it. You're trying to incorporate these steps, these goals of what you want to do. And there's like a whole laundry basket of stuff that we want and we need Liam to do in order to have him become independent enough to move out. But I can't just throw the whole laundry basket at him.
Right. That's where she says sometimes the parents' goals point in all directions. Oh, and there's too much. You set yourself up for failure when you try to get everything done. And you set your son or daughter up for failure, too, because it's just way too confusing.
Well, it's frustrating for everybody. Oh, my gosh. Nobody's going down a road. So prioritize your goals and then practice it with follow through. Yes, I really love that she said, this is not going to happen when you're late for work and you got to get going and the bus is coming and da 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 da. Yes. Yes, you have to do it then. But do it again at a calmer time. And then you can repeat it. Do it maybe 4 times in a row. Not too much to be frustrating, but enough to, you know, we're going to get used to doing this. And another term that I had learned in one of our therapies was scaffolding. I love that. Being a carpenter's daughter, it's really a good word. Scaffolding is supporting them, guiding them and supporting them until they're able to do it. And then I can take my support away. And then I also really loved her, stay on your priority list. Okay. Don't get influenced by other people's idea of what your priority should be. You guys decided that we're going to work on Liam zipping up his pants. That's all I'm working on today. And until he achieves that, that's what we're going to work on. Once he gets that, we'll move on to the next thing.
Basically, a small task accomplished is better than a multitask failure.
Indeed, indeed.
Well, the one that's related to what you just said is when the task is to build communication skills, they're going to go to a family event that's going to last a couple, 3 hours long. And instead of having to face 2 or 3 hours of greeting people and meeting people, you just say, we're going to say hello to 5 people. So we got a defined amount that is far less intimidating to a child with Asperger's or autism spectrum disorder to just have 5. They can count that. And I know that our Liam would count. That's 1. Mm-hmm. That's 2. He'd hold you, but he understands counting.
Yep.
Very, very well. To have it open-ended like that, she said it's like going to the gym for 3 hours. Nobody really wants to do that. You know, 45-minute workout sounds great. But keep it simple, yep. Keep it defined, keep it doable, and it'll turn out much better.
Right.
Was there anything else that you had?
Those are my immediate, hey, these things popped up in my head as her conversation was going on. And again, like I said, she had a whole lot of information that I thought was most excellent.
You know, there's one thing that she did mention about ABA that was new to me, actually. Applied behavioral analysis isn't just about behaviors. It's also about improvements in learning. Increasing the behaviors that lead to good learning and decreasing behaviors that point away from it.
Right.
But since the word behavioral is right in the middle of the two A's, I always thought it was for people that had unacceptable behaviors.
This was a myth buster that you just did.
Let's blow something up.
We did. It's that myth.
Perception enhancement. Let's call it that way.
Right. I like it.
Yeah.
Excellent. Very good.
If you found the information in today's episode helpful, please refer us to a friend who may also benefit from listening. Just ask them to type in nlawki.com, which is nlawki.com, into the computer browser, and all of our episodes will magically appear. Also, to receive notification of our episodes as they are released, please subscribe to our podcast through Apple, Spotify, Google, or whatever service you normally use for podcasts. We have many people to thank for the production of this podcast. First of all, I want to thank my co-host and the proprietor of the Nlawki Chat Cafe, my spouse and co-conspirator, Carrie Johnson.
And I want to thank my dear husband for dragging me into this.
Well, you did have the right to say no, but anyway. Next, we want to acknowledge Alex, our producer and sound engineer, for all the behind-the-scenes work he does. And then...
we want to thank Holly, our web designer and artistic director for the show. And
Daniela Munoz, our intern who manages post-interview communication with our guests, among other things nobody else really wants to do. But most importantly, we want to thank you, our listeners.